welcome to America.
Yes.
So when did you been here for a little while, haven't you?
No, I've been here for a week. I've just been up in Boston, in fact.
What were you doing up in Boston? Motion for the book?
A little bit, yes. It's really the Boston company like to sort of thank their authors, so they give us a dinner and a reception.
That's why I keep forgetting. Little Brown is based in Boston. One of two.
That's right.
Very substantial publishers.
Yes. Well, there's Houghton Mifflin.
Yeah, David Godin is also a relatively well-known publisher.
Yes, he's a nice publisher.
Yeah.
Nice books.
But both of the companies have offices here, and so I sometimes forget that their headquarters are up there in Boston.
Yes, well, I think we're all a tiny bit frightened that they'll centralize one day, but I hope not.
Well, we have one major publisher. Mm-hmm. As you know, the publishing industry is headquartered in New York in the United States, and we have one major publisher that left, and it went to, of all places, San Diego. Yes. Harcourt, Brace, and Jovanovich.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And it was strange. I mean, that struck everybody as a very awkward place to put a publishing house because in New York, it seems that there's an electronics district, a jewelry district, there is a flower district, a district where they sell bridal salons. And so all the publishing houses, while they're rather scattered now, they all tended to be in this one city.
Yeah.
Here they had a Maverick breaking away. And they ran into problems.
Yeah.
Because the publishing industry is very, very cannibalistic to begin with. And they need to see each other and talk to each other and take each other out to lunch and this sort of thing. Mm. And also the major media are headquartered in New York City.
Yeah.
So here the Harcourt, Brace, Jovanovich went to San Diego, and they had problems. So they reopened an office here, a small office, where they do a lot of work simply to get back into the mainstream.
Yeah.
Well, you have a substantial following in the United States, and I thought it was important that I speak to you while you're here, because I think that the listeners of my small broadcast, which is a news report, heard in New York and about four or five other CBS stations in the United States, I'm sure they'd like to know more about you. You've done a number of interviews. The publisher sent me some clippings you've done in the past. But I'd like to hear some of these. I'm sure I'm not going to surprise you with any new questions, but I'd like to hear some of your background in your own words. Now, I know you were born in England, 1926, and you served in the Marines. Was that a happy period, incidentally?
Yes, it was. I was born near London, at the mouth of the River Thames, about 30 miles from London. I didn't really like the district where I was born. I always longed for wilder country, but then a gentleman called Adolf Hitler fortunately turned up, and we had to move out of this area because it was in a major air raid area. And we went to Devon in the west of England, and that was a very happy period of my life, where I led a kind of Huck Finn kind of life, wandering around on my own in the woods and so on. And that really had a deep effect on me. And I did go into the Marines, but I did not enjoy them at all.
I can't understand that.
No, I know, you're not meant to say this, but the Marines in England are, well, your own are here, of course, are extremely full of what we used to call bullshit in those days. That's useless ceremonial, endless spit and polish, sergeants bullying recruits, and I didn't take to that at all.
I can't understand that you would just thrive on something like that.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
You studied at Oxford. What did you study?
I read French. You mustn't say studied at Oxford. You read something. I studied French, in effect. I began with French and German, but then the university changed its statutes, and you were allowed to do French alone. And so I gave up German and did French. And then a very happy 3 years of my life at Oxford. And then I went to teach in a French university, but to teach English. And for the first time, I really began to know English literature. because I had to teach it, so I had to do crash courses in all kinds of authors that any English graduate, you know, could have taught easily, but I had to learn it very fast from the ground, so to speak.
You also taught in Greece.
I had an option then. I was offered a post in a famous English school. The same week as I was offered a job in this very peculiar Greek college. It frankly wasn't a good college at all. It was really for rich dropouts. It was that kind of school. And of course I chose the bad job with no future. But that was because then I knew I wanted to write. And for a writer, if you have to choose between a good teaching post and a bad teaching post, I think you choose the bad one every time, because that gives you more time to do your own thing, writing.
When you say bad, you mean a post that is less challenging?
It was not challenging, because it was really teaching Greek boys to speak English, mm-hmm. and that really wasn't a particularly challenging job to do. And it was also a job without any future, you know. I mean, it was not a good thing to have on your record that you taught at the school in Greece. It was a very perverse decision, but it's an important one for me.
Well, that's an interesting thought that you raised. I've heard this before, where people have said that if one wishes to write, one should indeed seek a less demanding job, because that gives the potential writer the chance to focus on his craft without the involvement in a type of employment that could carry around the clock.
I agree with it, absolutely. The worst possible job as a writer you can take is teaching English at the high level, at university level, because if you do that efficiently, you really have to spend your life reading other people's criticism, reading everything that's going on if you're doing contemporary literature. And I don't think that's helpful at all if you're a writer. It's really better to teach something unconnected with writing and English literature. That's one little complaint I have about America, that the campus is such an important thing for the writers. You know, they all seem to congregate on campus, and I don't really think that's very good. I wouldn't recommend it.
John Fowles, your Huck Finn existence in your early days, and of course your decision to study French, any consistency there with the fact that you are now a writer? Was there anything in this early period in your life that gave some signal that someday you could put pen to paper or typewriter keys to paper?
I don't think so at all. But I think this is typical of novelists. If I was asked, you know, to show a class of high school kids which ones are likely to become writers, I would certainly choose the ones who are tongue-tied, who are backward in speaking, and who generally seem rather introverted.
Is that the way you were?
I certainly was, yes. I was certainly not a fluent public speaker. I've never been in my life. I hate getting into arguments because I know the other chap will always be much more eloquent and rational and all the rest of it. This is because, you see, we deal in print symbols. We don't deal in this medium where using at the moment. We simply communicate with other people by these weird 26 characters which we shift about. And I think in a way it's because we are not outward people that we are able to explore our own imaginations and how you express imagination. And so the kind of person who does get picked out for me, you know, when we're talking at the high school level, you know, he's going to be a good writer, almost always that doesn't happen. It's not the brilliant student who becomes the good writer.
There's still hope for me then.
Yes.
Well,
if you're modest.
Your first published work, I read many years ago as paperback, was The Collector, I believe. That was 1963. That was a wonderful book, which I think probably surprised a lot of people who perhaps didn't think it was as much as it was. I think subsequently you had described it as a fable. Is that correct? Had you used that term?
Well, it was widely reviewed in England when it first came out as a detective thriller.
Yes, I was going to say, that it was a mystery. I think that's perhaps why I read it.
Yes. And that was the one thing, really, I wasn't anxious to do. I mean, a fable sums it up, a kind of parable about existence in England at the time it was written in the 60s. Its success came as a shock to me, because I'm always pessimistic about my own books. And when it was taken up in England and then here in America, I was... Condeed, you know, I was a very innocent person suddenly thrown into this world of bestsellers and all that.
It was quite a success in the United States, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Perhaps more so than in England.
There is a great difference in the size of our two countries, as you know. So certainly in purely physical, financial terms, yes, it was a greater success here. And it's also been a success, oddly enough, in the Spanish speaking countries, quite why they like it so much. I think because it gives them what they like to think the English are like, you know, it sort of expresses what they really hate about the English.
I don't know, the Spanish are also, they have what is sometimes called a macho feeling, where men like to subordinate women, and perhaps that is behind their thinking, maybe that is their, I don't know.
Yes, kidnapping women's a good idea, anyway, that's happened.
You were working on a book that became the magus for quite a while during this period where you were also working on The Collector, weren't you?
Well, the magus was the first novel I attempted, but it was so difficult to get it into anything like publishable states. There came a time when I thought, I'm going to spend my whole life on this book, and I really need something short and much crisper than this book, and much easier to understand, in a way. And so I broke off and wrote The Collector. In fact, I wrote it in a month, the first draft of The Collector. And for me, it was a good idea. I've used it ever since. You break away, if you're stuck with the book you're on, you break away and start another book, or even finish another book. And then you come back to the one you've dropped. I'm a great believer in, periods when you don't think about something you're working on. And then when you come back to it, at least you hope some of the problems have gone away.
Well, you did something very unusual with the magus. I think only in a couple of occasions have I heard of something like that. John Barth wrote a book called The Floating Opera. Was it Floating Opera? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, yes, The Floating Opera. Mm-hmm. And then he revised it. That was his first book, and he revised it several years later. Well, you did the same thing. You revised the magus, and it was republished in 1977.
Yes.
Why did you do this?
This is because the success of The Collector rather went to my head. And I finished the magus off fairly fast after that. And then when it was out, I remember the very first copy I opened of it, I saw three sort of major boobs in the first page I read.
Boobs?
Well, that's the English word for stupid mistakes, blunders, bloomers. And I suddenly realized that I'd published it too soon. And so this haunted my conscience that I put out this book, which I could have got better if I'd taken a bit more time. And then, with more success, I was able to go to my publishers and say, this book I put out really wasn't done as well as I would have liked, and so can I have another shot at it? And they kindly let me do it.
That's unusual too.
Well, it is unusual.
You had to publish, say, no, John, you had your chance. Yes. Go on to something else.
Yes. Henry James did a lot of it, of course. He revised very heavily. Mm-hmm. And Whitman too, I think. It's something every writer really feels he would like a second shot, I think.
Poets are often like that too. The poet, Robert Lowell could not finish tinkering with a poem, even in printed form. Many of his poems came out in several books of poems came out in several versions. His notebook, for example, came out in no less than 3 different versions where he made a variety of changes, some small, some large. And he, every time he saw something of his in print, he would take a pencil and make some changes, and ultimately he would go ahead and publish it.
Well, I'm a, that's a good word, tinkerer. I'm a born tinkerer as well.
The French Lieutenant's Woman, that was a major success, I know, and you also worked on the screenplay, didn't you?
Of the French Lieutenant's Woman. Well, it was made by 2 friends, both the director and the scriptwriter, Harold Pinter.
You did not have a hand in this?
Well, we had discussions about, but that really is purely Harold and Carol's work. Harold is a marvellous, he's a marvellous sort of reducer of complicated novels, you know, because he did Proust also, although that wasn't made. And once you're in his hands, you really, you don't feel like interfering, because you know it's like being in a very safe driver's hands, you know, you respect what he does. But we had little meetings, and I would complain about small things and all the rest of it.
How the movie, when it was finished, to your satisfaction?
Yes, yes, it's the one movie of mine that I really do quite like. I'm not complaining about it in the least. I mean, every author can complain about a movie made of his book, but mine are a very, very slight there. Meryl Streep also, you see, it wasn't my choice, it was the director's choice that she should play the part, and I thought she did marvellously, and I think he made the right choice in picking her.
Daniel Martin, your most autobiographical, well, I don't know if that's the term, autobiographical, but at least a novel in which you express yourself in the most direct way, I guess. What prompted you to change your horses, so to speak, after writing the Victorian-type novel, The French Lieutenant's Woman, and write something like Daniel Martin? Or do you like to really go back styles and approaches?
An honest answer to that is that every writer bores himself on occasion. And this has always been a nightmare. I've got a very low boredom threshold. And I hate the notion that, I mean, it works for some novelists, that you are fixed in one kind of book, and so you always reproduce that. It can work, Graham Greene rather does that, Faulkner rather did it. I mean, it can be a good way of writing, that you take some tiny area of the world and all your work falls within that small county in which you picked for yourself. I have never wanted that, and I also wanted to say something about my generation in England, which I think is rather a weak.
Is rather what?
A weak, damaging generation. I mean, the sort of people who were at Oxford and Cambridge in my time. So that was one purpose, and I also wanted to talk about art, you know, the art of writing. And I really, that was why I moved it into the present, because I wanted to write a contemporary novel. I didn't want it to be known that I was dealing in the Victorian period.
Well, you went to the pre-Victorian period with your newest book, A Maggot, and what is the significance of the title?
The title, it's a very complicated word if you go into its history. In the 18th century, it didn't have any kind of insect sense. It had the sense of a quirk, something that, you know, that's a kind of little obsession with you. And it had a musical sense, too. It meant a small dance that obsessed somebody. And so they wrote a little air, and it was usually called Mr. So-and-so's Maggot or Mistress So-and-so's Maggot. And you find these dances quite often in the literature of the period. And that really was what I thought of this book as, that is, as a kind of quirk of mine, feelings I have about history, and also that it was a kind of dance. In other words, it wasn't meant to be the normal kind of historical novel. It was much more my dream of drifting back into that century, explaining what I feel about it now, what it means, whether it has any relevance to us. This is because I don't like historical novels proper. I love true history. I'm always love to read, the real documents for the period. But writing that fiction, it doesn't really interest me very much. I just wanted to make people feel it's in a slightly dream-like feeling what it would have been like if we could go back and live in that period.
Well, I have no personal knowledge of the language or how people spoke during that era, but certainly in reading a maggot, I had the feeling that this seemed accurate to me.
Well, I hope so, yes. I mean, I wanted to give that feeling. But if I was a historian, strict historian, you see, I'd have done it all through documents of the period. I have put in some documents of the period in that book, because I don't want to cheat. I want people to realize this is how they really spoke and what the writing looked like, what the grammar was and the strange words they sometimes used and what life was like socially. That was really to distinguish from what I'm doing, which
yes,
is...
Those historical documents were quite interesting,
yes.
As you trace the months through 1836,
yes.
And I didn't read them all, but I yes. looked at some of them, and you mm-hmm. had, I guess these were newspapers, is that correct?
Because well, they come from something called the Gentleman's Magazine, and this was very like Time or Newsweek today, except it was monthly. But every month it used to round up the news, it used to print all the political debates, it used to report what was going on in other magazines and papers of the time. So it was really, you picked up everything that happened during the last month. And part of it was what I printed, the News Chronicle, which simply wrote down the sort of news events of the month. Historians know this book very well. It's a major source for the whole 18th century.
And John Fowles, you assert that a maggot is not a historical novel, and what you do, of course, is to, in effect, trace in a fictional way the origins of Anne Lee, brought the Shaker religion to the United States. But you have made up all of the events leading to this birth.
Well, I've been very naughty by strict historical standards because I've really attributed to Anne Lee's mother, of whom we know very, very little in real history, I've attributed to her a lot of the feelings that we know were associated with her daughter. So really, I've moved history backwards. Anne Lee, I mean, really became interested in what became Shakerism about the 1770s, I think, it first showed in her. But of course, I've suggested it was in her mother and much earlier than that. But Andy, I adore. I really have greatest respect for that woman.
There is a certain ambiguity about a maggot, and some of the critics have already raised this. But I have a feeling that it was deliberate. Can you comment on that?
Which was...
an ambiguity was about the book and what is happening and
yes,
various events.
Yes, I don't explain many things. And this, I know, is very wicked in America not to explain clearly what you mean your story to say. But this really is part of my theory of the novel, that the reader really has an enormous part to play, and therefore you can leave gaps, which it's for the reader to fill in a way, or to interpret it, as the reader wants. And this is simply because the reading experience requires a writer and a reader. We're really, during the reading of a book, we're equal, really, because the reader makes an enormous amount of what we don't say. There are always gaps in the novel, and the reader fills it in. This is what's so valuable about the novel.
Of course, you do have an epilogue where you try to explain why you did what you did, and was that epilogue also in the English edition?
Yes.
Same epilogue?
Yes. I mean, I'll be frank. I'll say it's, although I'm an atheist, in fact, it's a little bit of a sermon. It's only 5 or 6 pages, but I'm really saying that I think the Shakers deserve a second look. I mean, some of their theories are incredible to us today, you know, the notion that mankind is happier without sex and so on. But I think to a lesser degree, there was a lot of sense in many of the things they said.
Well, not only do you assert that you are an atheist, you assert that you are a convinced atheist.
Yes,
what
I
is
am.
A convinced atheist? As opposed to an atheist?
Well, I suppose, when I was younger, people used to say they were atheists, and it didn't really mean very much. But I really mean that I sincerely have no belief in an omnipotent God. I have no belief in an afterlife. I have no belief in the miraculous aspects of Jesus Christ's life. And no established religion today means anything to me. But if we go into the past, it's very different, because religion was the way that people communicated. And religious debates, you know, in the period of the book, was really the kind of method of language by which people often were really expressing what we call social or political or liberal or not liberal sentiments. It was a kind of all-pervasive medium by which people communicated. And that part of it has always interested me very much.
It'll be interesting to see how many readers John Fowles loses in the American Bible Belt.
Yes.
As a result of those assertions. And also in the epilogue, you take to task the evangelical religions in the United States and their Madison Avenue approach.
Techniques. Yes, I have no respect for them at all, I'm afraid, except to the extent that they're dissenting. I will forgive almost any kind of dissenter, but I'm not really sure that much modern evangelism, you know, the Bible Belt, is really dissenting. It seems to me to be a conforming movement.
I think you're absolutely right. Why do you believe there should be an end to all organized religions? I mean, taking into account the fact that you are not a believer in a higher being, but assuming that people have a right to assemble on this sort of thing, what is then a disadvantage?
Well, the most important of all, I think, is that man should always be free to choose what he wants. So I'm not suggesting anything tyrannical. I mean, nothing like Soviet Russia and trying to stamp out religion at all. But I do think for the mental health of the species, it would be better if all sorts of myths, what are me, religious myths, really slowly drop out. I feel obviously for the last 100 years they have been withering away. I'm really saying I would like to encourage that rather than reverse.
Well, what's particularly frightening about the organized religionists is that generally they try to impose their beliefs through legislation and fiat.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there is an organization you may have heard of in this country called the Moral Majority, which seeks political ends for their religion and has sought legislation to impose all sorts of it, whether it's compelling people to say prayers in public schools or to impose their beliefs with regard to abortion. Mm-hmm. But these are people who don't think as highly, it seems to me, of our Constitution, which specifically mandates a separation. But there are constant efforts to erode this amendment in our Constitution, constantly from people who firmly believe that their beliefs should be adhered to by others. And I don't know how that is expressed in England. I don't know if it's as
well. We see on television, and we hear quite a lot about the middle majority. And I'm happy to say that in England, I think it's generally despised. I mean, no one wants to import that into England at all.
We've got enough problems.
We've got enough problems.
Including rioting and Birmingham.
The Clarence Darrow, the evolution debate, I mean, that's well known in England, too. Not teaching evolution in high school and so on. And that shocks us. I mean, there's no other word for it.
John Fowles, you're quoted as saying, I don't know, I can't remember where I read it, one of the interviews that I saw with you, this stuck out of my mind, I thought it was quite interesting. You're quoted as saying that art is genetic, and that one must be born a serious artist, that a serious artist or a gifted artist is not made, it's not created, but is born. Can you amplify that remark for me?
Well, I think America is interesting at the moment because there's so much art going on. It's for me, it's absolutely bewildering. Say, in New England, how many galleries, artists, painters, sculptors, potters are about. And what I feel about that is that that is excellent in as much as I believe, you know, if people can treat art as an enjoyable activity, I have no objection to that. But I'm a little suspicious of the demand that if you take up art, then you hope to be famous. Because I think here biology comes into it. And the kind of conditions that make a writer or make a good sculptor or a good potter, whatever you want, are extremely rare. So there's always a kind of statistical balance against you, a weight against you. And I don't like really thinking of art as a kind of way of becoming famous or celebrated. I mean, that sort of, in every artist, of course, there's a dream. I shall be Rembrandt, I shall be Mozart and all the rest of it. But this kind of worries me because I think it produces rather futile vanities and neuroses in the people doing the art. They get, you know, extremely hurt that their art isn't more widely or better received. But you see, that's totally irrational. It's like having marvellous baseball players or anything else. You know, they're always going to be rare on the ground.
Yes, I noticed that it's primarily the failed artists who always go to Washington hat in hand and say, we must do more to promote the arts. The Broadway theater is having a bad year and we need federal aid. Probably having a bad year because people aren't going, and the reason they're not going is that the art in the theater is not very good. So many of the seats are empty. And it's worthy to support and promote the arts, but I have this feeling that it is the failed artists who are the ones who want the subsidies to promote their art, because nobody pays attention to them otherwise.
Absolutely. And they'll blame anyone, of course. You know, if only I had a better agent and I've got the wrong publisher and so on. And I don't believe all of that. It's really their inability to face that we're talking about an activity which isn't fair in a kind of way. It's highly unfair, art. You know, I mean, many very evil human beings have been extremely good artists, unfortunately. So there's no kind of moral justification for becoming a successful artist. You can be an absolute swine, a pig, as a human being, and be an extremely successful artist.
Well, John, if I was to wrap things up, let me ask you, do you normally have a literary project going, or are you of the nature to take extended breaks after publishing a book such as The Maggot?
I would say I'm of a nature to take the breaks, because when you've done a long novel, you do feel, in a psychic way, exhausted. I mean, you probably feel physically exhausted also, but it's your mind feels absolutely washed out. You know, it's an empty water skin, and somehow the rain's got to fall, i.e. time's got to pass, and you can get it filled up again. And so I do very minor things at this kind of period, just after publishing.
How, other than making appearances like this, do you occupy yourself? I understand you have an interest in nature.
I have a very great interest in nature, and I run a little museum in the very small town where I live in England.
You're the curator?
I'm the curator, the honorary curator.
Natural History Museum.
It's not really. It's a local history museum, but it so happens we're in a very important fossil area in Britain. The fossils of Lyme Regis, the town, are famous all over the world of geology, because this is where many of the first discoveries about paleontology, about the fossil world, were made. So Lyme Regis specimens, I suppose, must be in every major museum in the world. And I'm an amateur in that, but I find it interesting you know, to see these 150-million-year-old beasts discovered and dug up. And
so I imagine you're the local celebrity in Lyme Regis as well.
I try not to be, no. It's
Your fans come trooping from London, knocking at your door? Or?
They come trooping from California, from places like that. It gets a little tedious, that, you know, the constant letters which you never keep up with, and people knocking on your door when you're busy working yourself.
I hope they don't come with manuscript in hand saying, will you read my manuscript and give me your opinion?
Not too much, thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
Because I can't do that. It takes too much time.
Well, John Fowles, we've talked a little longer than I expected. You're certainly easy to talk to. Not knowing you, I was uncertain, and when you see a formidable looking man with a beard, you wonder, gee, is he going to be tough to talk to? Mm. But you were very easy to talk to, and I've wanted to speak to you for a long time, and this was a wonderful opportunity to do it, and I really appreciate that you took the time to come in and talk to me, and I certainly hope that you enjoy your rest of your stay in America. And I have one piece of advice to you. Stay away from the Bible Belt.
Yeah, I do know that.